Welcome to Blind Shovel, an arts and music podcast. Today I speak with devotional artist Anthony Visco. Enjoy.
Okay, how are you?
I'm good.
Good. So, sure. Do you record this and then broadcast it or what?
Yes. I don't do it live.
Oh, okay, that was my question.
And I'll send it to you before it goes out. So, you know, I've had some artists give me like a timestamp of everything they said they wanted to erase. Generally speaking, if there's a section or something you don't want going out there, that's no issue.
Sure.
I completely understand that. All right. Well,
I usually don't have that issue. So
good.
Yeah. Never done it before. So,
well, I suppose it makes,
I've done pocket, but I've never done that thing where I go through it and if I said it, I said it. I don't have time to.
Exactly. But you know,
I really don't.
You're at an age where I'm sure you have grace about that, where these younger artists, they're stepping on eggshells, you know?
That's interesting, but I agree. I've noticed that
it's not good.
No, it's not. It's a serious issue because, and I think that is part of the sort of modernist idea of how we do things, and in terms of making art. So you've got to choose the exact words so that your critics will have absolutely no issue at all.
Yeah.
And
well, I don't think there's any redemptive spirit built into their worldview, so that applies to themselves and others. And so
exactly.
There's a deep fear of, well, being judged eternally via the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Via these recorded means. Meanwhile, no one cares, you know. They'll care when
No,
you matter,
that's the bottom line. No one cares.
Yeah.
So,
but they'll dig through your file one day if you're powerful enough or matter enough, and then they'll find the things. But it doesn't matter, you know. It really doesn't.
No, we had a teacher in art college in the late '60s, and it was sort of a sculpture philosophy class. We really didn't make anything in that class. I think it was called Sculpture Problems or something like that. And the guy was a brilliant teacher and could do things that none of the other teachers could do, aside from teaching this class. But nevertheless, he was really looked down upon because he was doing what we called figurative sculpture. Mm-hmm. And no one else in the department was doing that. So, of course, he was prohibited from teaching it. You know, God forbid someone should do the human anatomy. So anyway, this issue came up about, you know, what an artist can do. And he said, well, you can really pretty much do anything you want. That's up to the artist. That's up to the individual. You can choose the kind of sculpture you want to do and how you're going to do it. And you have these controls over all this and that. And he said, but there's one thing you have absolutely no control over. He said, the time in which you were born, the period in which you are working. And he said, for better, for worse, ladies and gentlemen, you are born in a low art period. And that was back in the 60s. And here we are, you know, over, you know, half a century ago. And it's true more now than ever. He said, however, sometimes in the future, someone may look back and say, wait a minute, not everybody was doing that. There were some people who were doing this.
Right.
And that's why I have to look at it all the time. I mean, if I'm fortunate enough to get dug up again, they'll say, well, it's not everybody was, you know, scribbling and vomiting. We'll see.
Was this teacher making particularly religious or Christian work, or just simply figurative work?
Here's the irony of all that, Michael. Okay, he was raised Orthodox Jew in pre-World War II Germany, and his folks got here just in time. Wow. He fancied himself an atheist, but he did nothing but heroic and epic themes in his sculpture, such as, you know, Greek mythology. So he would do things like the death of Apollo and on all these different heroic themes and the architecture and the mathematics that went along with it. Ironically, he was commissioned by the Archdiocese of Philadelphia during the 1976 International Eucharistic Congress that was held here. And he had one request, and that was to have a liturgical consultant and advisor. And he was given Monsignor Miller, John Miller, who was a brilliant man. So when Walter said, I want to do an Apollo Christ, Monsignor knew exactly what he was saying. He wants to bring into the Congress the idea of the Apollo Christ, the beardless Christ, the first century that Christ that we see in catacomb paintings. Walter did it. It was very successful. It's still at the outside of the cathedral. But I don't feel that there was any acknowledged conversion experience if Walter continued after that, but never did anything like it again.
Well, that's an interesting... I was thinking about this earlier in respect to inspiration of the muse versus devotional work, in the sense of, do you rely upon the muse, though? Which it feels like a kind of secular idea to me, this kind of neutral, ephemeral spirit that gives inspiration and ideas versus devotional work that's directly related to God.
Yes. Well, I see it this way. You're either following the Zeitgeist or the Holy Spirit. They both come. I do think the Holy Spirit can come in the form of a dove or a muse, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just that one is sacred and one is secular. And there are people that are trying to bridge the both. And I think even in terms of sacred art, they want to make it relevant. They want to bring some contemporary thing into it. And as if that's what was happening during the greatest periods of world art history. They don't, it's not that they can't be inspired by both, but it seems that the more mundane they become, the less they become devotional. And sometimes it can go the other way, that people were so burdened with, you know, with religiosity that it has no artifice. So there's got to be a balance between the both. I mean, I remember, being in Italy and sitting out on a summer night with some people in the South, and this husband and wife were arguing over Michelangelo's Pietà and whether it was religious or secular, in that the wife felt that it had more art than religion, and he felt that it had more religion than art. Or but I thought, this is a rarefied argument. Here's this, you know, kind of working class husband and wife in Sulmona Abruzzo arguing over, and who knows if they ever saw it? That's the other thing. Who knows if they ever really got to Rome to see it? That would have been uncommon. So anyway, but I thought, this is an argument that I never even heard in 4 years of art college, that's for sure.
Right. I mean, I think it's important to have, because a lot of these younger artists, it's probably never even occurred to them, this question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether explicitly acknowledged or not, most artists are aiming at a transcendent principle. And it might not be religious per se, but it begs the question, where's the transcendent if not, if there is no God? So I don't think there is a way to square that circle. And so it's a conversation worth having. I came to a conclusion that the muse isn't neutral, that it could also be negative or demonic, and that has to be investigated, even via the process of making, I think. And once once you accept that, then you can accept a kind of, I think, a decline or ascension in respect to art history.
I agree. There is a way of seeing it, but you know, it's happened so culturally and globally now. I started to see this in Florence in particular, because I knew, having studied there, I knew the churches and the artwork so well. I could walk into the Duomo and see Michelangelo's Bandini Pietà in the side chapel it was designed for, and stand there and draw it. Got the drawings to prove it. And go to Masaccio's frescoes and draw them in situ. Not a problem. Now we go, and the churches have been stripped. Not by the state, by the way, but by the church itself, in particular the Archdiocese in Florence, and in particular Monsignor Timothy Vernon, who oversees all this, an American Monsignor. The churches have been stripped of Catholic patrimony, these masterpieces. Right now they're too good to be used in liturgy or devotion. So they're taken into the Opera del Duomo, now seen as art, only art. So people stand in line to go see these empty churches and pay, by the way, and then stand in line and pay to see the art that was once in there.
So in a sense, it's been transferred from devotional to cultural, and it's now just art, and has been put in the mausoleums.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Effectively. You can hang it next to a Cy Twombly. It's all art. In fact, there was one. No, Michael, seriously, there was one season I was there, and Abramovich was having a show simultaneously with that season at Palazzo Strozzi. However, Monsignor Vernon decided to take this big sort of poster of hers, where she's got these two fake knees spread way, way, way apart, and wearing a red dress, and she's got this guy draped over her knees, like she's you know, it's the Pietà, and right next to Michelangelo's incredible sculpture of the Pietà. I mean,
yeah. Europe is lost. Europe is very lost in my experience.
It can't come back. I'll never see it come back. Let me put it that way. It has cultural amnesia.
Yeah, I've never been to a place so steeped in the religious tradition, but so resistant to it at the same time. It's very interesting. My wife is French, and it's fascinating to me how they'll be aware of saints' days specifically, or this or that, very like things Americans would never be aware of, but then they're like ardently atheistic about everyday life, I feel, even the way they approach marriage or family, etc. There's like, it's like a resentment of a teenager being raised religious and then looking back at it in a kind of cynical way.
Oh yes. Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. I have a dear friend, my oldest friend in Florence. We've been friends for over 50 years. And he always, you know, declared himself an atheist, you know, like a lot of them do. But then certain things happen, and I'll say, but wait a minute, I thought you were yes, but I'm culturally Catholic. Mm-hmm. Oh, make up your mind. You don't go to, you don't, you know, and it's a shame because he's not stupid. I know that, but, and I don't know what made him turn off the whole idea, but maybe because he's surrounded all the time. His wife is Japanese, and she was Shinto Buddhist. But yet, when we go on these little side trips, you know, she goes into every church. She lights candles. She has a sense of it that he doesn't, but he doesn't explain anything to her. I've noticed that. You know, I go with them, and I say, well, this we use this for this and that for that, and she's amazed. She had no idea. And here she is, you know.
Well, yeah, I think that just comes down to a fundamental orientation towards the sacred, which I feel that the Japanese have in a way that I don't understand because I don't understand Eastern philosophy very well.
They have a moral aesthetic, and I've witnessed that with her as well, where we, you know, I remember we were at a train station in Bologna waiting for the train to come, get back to Florence, and it's late, Buzzy. It's just late. And she said, this is what I hate about Italy. And she said, this would never happen in Japan. And she said, it's just morally wrong to be late. So I think that there's a whole sort of, I think that's at the root of it in a sense, you know, that manners speak a lot. And, you know, there's a moral aesthetic to a gesture, to everything. And that sort of moral aesthetic is when it's continued into sacred art becomes one of the most important elements, because that's what I think is the transcendent, one of the things that allows it to be transcendental. You know, Thomas Aquinas talks about that. We've lost that, where essentially it is good because it does good.
Right.
So if it's going to make people stand in front of it and argue, well, you know, I like the way she let those drips come down. And so I don't like the way she let those drips go down. Well, I think she had a right to let those drips go down, even though I don't like them. That's
art school. Yeah, I went to UArts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been there.
Oh boy. What did you major in what?
Well, fortunately, illustration. Which was quite
that
rigorous.
To me that was one of the I taught in the illustration department for 3 years. I was forbidden to teach in fine arts because I taught anatomy. How dare you?
Yes.
So but I loved it. I loved teaching why, Michael? Because I found that those students in illustration still had that link to the heroic. Hmm. They loved the eight-headed figure. They kind of knew those proportions intuitively. And of course, at that time, they were still big on Star Wars, and of course, I could understand that because for me and my generation, the heroic was things like Ben-Hur. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we still had that sense of epic. Although couldn't continue, we didn't, because I was an illustration major, but I went completely non-representational all during those years at UArts.
You did?
It was amazing. Oh yeah, I did. I was the good bad boy. I couldn't do anything mm-hmm. wrong. I mean,
I'm actually curious to hear more about the dynamic of going there in the '60s. Were you overtly, how would you say this? Were you closeted in the sense of you were hiding certain values because of the environment
No, I wasn't hiding it. I was told in a very sort of kind way that gee, you would have been incredible in the 15th century. But so you're told that your work is anachronistic, that you're out of touch with the times. They convince you that you're out of your element, that all the people that you say you liked, you know, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Perugino, Raffaello, Tiepolo, Bernini, they were so great because they paid attention to the time that they were in. You are not. So it took me, the first year was really rough. And but if a teacher says something like, okay, I want you to go home and do a line drawing tonight, you know, I would go home and copy an Ang drawing or something like that, because I thought it dealt with one. But the next day, the kid that brings in the garden hose wins.
Yeah.
Okay. And the teacher says, see, folks, this is what I'm talking about. So you learn very early in the game that you're not getting it right at all. Your work's not being talked about. And not that you want to necessarily, you want to do good. I mean, you're 18 years old. It's your first time in art school. You want your teachers to give you some affirmation that you're on the right track.
You want the world to as well.
Sure. But I remember going to, I said, you know, you give us these problems, as they would call them. And I said, I really think I'm, you know, answering them, but you never say anything. I don't understand, you know, am I really that bad? And he said, well, I'll tell you what the problem is. You think art is an answer. Art is a question.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, I'm getting it. See, I'm getting it now. So easily by, you know, my second year, I was doing things like rearranging dump sites before and after. I got it. I finally got it.
Mm-hmm.
And won scholarships for it. Got my Fulbright for it. I mean, if I were to show people the portfolio that I, for which I won a Fulbright, it's, oh, that's impossible. No, it wasn't impossible. It's more possible even now than it was then.
Can you elaborate on the distinction, the feeling between making that work versus making the work you make now?
Oh, sure. Like I was saying earlier, I could do no wrong. And, you know, for example, my last year drawing class, I told the teacher, I'm not coming to class. I don't draw like that anymore. And I would do things like tear up paper and then glue it back together again. All the rough at nothing. And I'd leave it on the floor. And he'd come to my studio, and this is 1969. Okay. So, of course, I'm going to say, he'll say, is that it? Yes. Why is it on the floor? Who says the drawing has to be on the wall? Okay. Oh. What about that? Why does it have to have edges and corners? Drawing could be anything. And I wasn't trying to be wise-assy about it, but I thought you're telling me I should be challenging and making questions, not answers. So I'm doing it. I'm doing exactly what you trained me to do. So one day we're sitting down and I did a floor rubbing as a drawing, just rubbed whatever dust or particles were on the floor and hung it up. And he starts talking about how he can see the relationship to the Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism. And I thought, you know, I'm a kid from Northeast Philadelphia, raised Catholic. I take the Frankfurt L every day. I don't know what you're talking about. But the mm-hmm. fact that he said that made me realize that something's wrong here. That one of us is really off. And that was one of the turning points that I had. And so I started to change even before I left for Italy. But by the time I got there, having that summer to think about things and say, aha, I know what I want to do now. And I got there and I realized now you are absolutely free to do this. And then seeing the work there in situ, Michael, in situ, remember that part, because now it's all gone. But
right.
I don't know how it would have been for me if I were to go today, because that's what I got off the train. I'm staying in front of Masaccio's Holy Trinity fresco, and I see the prayed you. I see the wilted flowers. I see the old lady praying in front of it. And none of those things have been taken out. You know, all those things, excuse me, were removed in the art history books. But I realized at that point that all this incredible work that I had loved is alive and well, and it's still being used. And that continued throughout my entire year of study there, where, of course, joining in with the different holy days and festivities just proved it even more. So my calendar was, even though I'm studying art and art history, it was based on what town, what city is having what on what saint's day, because now I can have it all. So
exactly. Yeah.
you go to Padua for the feast of Saint Anthony, and I'm surrounded with the Scrivegni Chapel and Donatello and Verrocchio. I mean, it's all there and it's being used. So
I want to highlight that being used, the utility of that. Can you elaborate on that? You mean devotionally?
Devotionally, just in terms of sort of taking the spirit to another place, because it becomes unworldly in that context. You see the entire, you know, it involves the senses like nothing else. You know, the sounds, the smells, all of it. The other people, it is both individual and communal, and that doesn't happen in contemporary art or modernist art. Let me put it that way. It can't happen in contemporary, but modernist, it cannot happen. It's always the individual, and it's always subjective.
Well, but it's also anti-utilitarian in the sense of,
yes,
any form of utility is suspicious, which, I mean, if you're from a lower or middle class, that should raise some alarm bells. Basically, anything that provides a function, mm-hmm, is lower. I mean, only the highest form of luxury could arrive, sure, at such a notion.
It's
absurd.
It's absurd, and so that's why the manual, the handcraft is always suspicious. You know, that, I mean, when I was in school, you can't rely on what they called native talents or native skills. They didn't call it talent. Talent, that was a bad word. Native skills. That means you were born with that. So what? Who cares? That's an accident. It's a birth accident.
Right, because God didn't give you the gift. It was chaos unfairly provided an advantage.
Yeah, just a roll of the dice. That's all.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. It's very, very defeatist.
And it's something that, you know, does go back because even Da Vinci had to deal with this in terms of the academics. You know, you work with your hands, you lowly thing. You know, you're not liberated yet.
Right.
Okay. So, and his challenge to that was, you put my crucifix up and nail your poem on the wall, and we'll see which one people kneel in front of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, but, and, you know, it's what's interesting, Michael, making studio classes into accredited classes hasn't helped either. You know.
Interesting. Yeah. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's allowed artists to think that they are on the same intellectual level, no matter what they do, because they got the credits for it. But they're still not studying those other things that would make it more of a worthy degree. Just because they have a BFA or a master's degree in art, they still can't do anything.
Right.
So the accreditation didn't provide anything other than, you know, oh, well, maybe now you can get a teaching job and teach the same nonsense. I won't write a letter of recommendation for anyone that wants to go to a fine arts school for an MFA. I refuse. Absolutely not. It's a waste of time and money. You'll never be able to get that money back.
Yeah, and so you're speaking to the studio structure, which you do run a studio, right?
Yes.
Versus the academic structure of today, which used to be this, I would assume they used to be the same. But I understand what you mean. There's no true signifier of the skill set looking at a degree today versus in a studio structure. I'm sure there's a very clear hierarchy of almost like a martial art, I assume. Like you need to be here before you can do this or that.
That's part of it, Michael. But when you said utilitarian, one of the biggest curses of my entire career was the fact that I lowered myself to do commissions. Now, I was fine with those people commissioning me, but amongst my so-called peers and coworkers, that's something that an artist is never supposed to do. And it relates to what you said about being utilitarian. I love the fact that my work could have been used in a greater context. But, you know, every once in a while, in all my years at the Pennsylvania Academy, a teacher would come and say, could I ask you something personal? Yeah, sure. Are you still doing commissions or are you like getting any of your own work done? I could never convince them that that is my work, that people commission me because they want one of mine. Okay.
Well, that's an interesting, this idea of self-expression.
Yes. Yeah.
So where is the self in this kind of work? Or is it, in terms of priority, it's not the top priority, correct?
Well, to me, you know, sometimes in the earlier days when I was doing commission work, I'd have somebody come over to the studio and then look at it. And not for their critique, but that's what I was doing. You know, you're in my studio, so you're going to see what I'm working on. And they'd say, oh, that's really nice, but where are you in it? And I'd say, it's not about me. It's a lot of artists could not understand that basic concept. It's not about me.
Right.
I can't not be in it. It's my hand, that hand that, you know, I got misplaced at birth or whatever. You know, and I've even had this happen when, you know, somebody could go to a church where I've done the Stations of the Cross, you know, sculpted them or whatever. And they'll say, every time I do the Stations, I think of you. And I'll say, I must have done a bad job then. You're not supposed to be thinking of me when you do the Stations of the Cross.
Yeah. So, it does make me wonder. I've long thought that all the neuroses and mental health illness that is associated with the modern artist is directly related to their own egotistical relationship to their own. Well, they're just working for their own sake. So
yes.
Yeah. If you asked anyone who did any job, if they spent all day thinking about themselves, they'd probably have a mental illness, is my
Absolutely.
Guess.
Yes.
So I don't think it's related to art making, the suffering. It's related to narcissism. And it's a trick, too. I mean, I completely sympathize because when you're, like you said, when you're devalued for doing anything utilitarian in school, the logical conclusion is, well, I have to dig deeper into myself and I'll find something there. But the truth is, there's obviously some very true limits to the self, and all you're going to find is the bottom of the hole, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I agree. But sometimes, unfortunately, it does get endorsed in art schools. I remember we had one young man who, although, you know, he could paint, he definitely had serious mental issues, psychological issues, I should say. And I remember when he hung his final exhibition, which he won a travel scholarship for, one of the teachers stood there in front of the wall and said, I wish I was as crazy as this guy.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
young man, yeah. Unfortunately, that young man went over to Europe and got was taken in by Odd Nerdrum, you know, as one of the students that was studying him for the summer. He woke up in the middle of the night with a big kitchen knife and went in to try to stab Odd Nerdrum to death. Of course, he had to leave the next morning or in the middle of the night, whatever. But the poor kid needed help.
Right.
So, yeah, a lot of times that kind of gets encouraged in art schools, that, you know, and it's seen as it's not seen as anything that's disruptive. It's just they think that gotta be crazy. You know, crazy artists make great work.
Well, also, it's simply a novelty to commodify.
Yeah, I call it the Van Gogh syndrome. I was very fortunate my first year of art school. There was a wonderful teacher, and she made a comment about that and said, I'd like to be as crazy as Van Gogh. And the teacher said, don't ever confuse his mental illness with his painting or his artistic skills. They had nothing. It didn't come from that. The fact that he could paint to try to overcome that was one thing, but his paintings weren't a product of his mental illness. And that was I remember having an impact on me, her saying that, because, you know.
Do you believe that?
That they were separate?
Yeah.
He was probably in his, like, let me put it this way. He was in a better state of mental health when he was doing those paintings. They don't, when I see all the things I've seen in all the years I was teaching from students that had severe health, you know, mental health issues, there's definitely a difference. Definitely a difference. They could not could have composed those things or whatever. I think they came from a healthier place in his mind.
Yeah, like his better half. Effectively.
Yes, exactly. That's what she was trying to express, you know.
Yeah, you know, there's a similar thing with drugs where people think you take drugs and then you make good art. But in fact, if you read about most artists in this position, it's the complete opposite. The drugs stop them from making. Any idiosyncratic expression usually comes from suffering, not from drugs, you know.
Michael, they were my 4 years of UArts. Most of the students, I was terrified of drugs. I wouldn't go anywhere near them. But I would go into class the next morning, and students would come up and say, you want to see my speed drawings from last night? And they would show them to the teachers. They wouldn't say, these are my speed drawings from last night. They would just show them. The teachers would just marvel over them. You could do no wrong. And I saw some very talented people come in the first year, and by by graduation, they were completely destroyed from LSD or marijuana, what you name it. They were taking everything, and the teachers never caught on. Never. In fact, some of them even did it with them. You know, it was a whole breakdown. We came into school, and our teachers were Mr., Mrs., and Miss. And one day, they brought us into the studio, sat on the floor, and said, you are no longer to call us Mr. So-and-so and Ms. So-and-so and whatever, and introduced themselves again with their first name.
Interesting.
Except for one teacher who sat, not on the floor, but in a chair. And he was the last one. And again, it was Walter Erlbacher. And he said, you will address me as Mr. Erlbacher. You are not my peers. Boom.
And there you see that the great flattening.
Yes.
And in respect to the question I was asking about the difference between the modes of making devotional versus, I guess, art for art's sake, I think you can't go anywhere in a horizontal profane space. You can go left to right, but until you engage with vertical principles that have clear hierarchies and make demands of you, you'll be stuck. You'll just be there. And I think that's mirrored in this kind of non-hierarchical teacher structure as well. Again, very different than the studio, which clearly it's more of an initiation process.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I I compete with myself. That's why I tell people, they say, I just want to do better than what I did before. I mean, there's not a commission or sculpture, even though I do my own work, by the way, for those that want to, you know, so do you ever get any of your own work done? Yeah. Sometimes my commissions don't provide me with the, don't fulfill all my interests or all my visions. So I go ahead, I do it anyway. And, you know, someone might come in and years later, and that's happening to me as we speak, and saying, who did you do this for? And I said, I did it from, you know, cause I wanted to. It wasn't a commission. No. And they become actually interested in, is it possible to do it? Yes, absolutely.
Right.
So things like that happen.
Right. It's not a binary, like you were saying earlier.
No.
There has to be a balance between the two. And actually finding that balance is quite difficult. You can kind of see it in the cheesiness of quote unquote Christian rock sometimes, where it's been reduced to this, like, I don't know how to word it, milquetoast identity.
Mm-hmm.
It has no edge to it.
Absolutely not. Well, we've seen that in a lot of contemporary Catholic art as well. I can't stand the cartoony nature of things on EWTN. Just Google Happy Saints. They look like South Park figures. This flattening of things.
Yes.
You know. Which I have some suspicions about, you know, in terms of what that does sacramentally, when we make everything flat, that's like anti-corporeal.
And so how do you feel about the flatness that occurs at times in the pre-Renaissance?
For example, you mean like...
You look at like a Giotto and it's like much more flat and iconographic. It's not... like the high Renaissance.
No. It's but it's sincere. It's not feigned naivete.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big factor for me. He's not pretending at all, nor is Fra Angelico. It's the what we call Italo-Byzantine, where they're taking from the Byzantine, and mostly the iconography, not the style, because the Byzantine iconography is very clear that if you're depicting the presentation in the temple, you've got Simeon, Mary, Christ child. That's bare minimum. You can put in Saint Joseph. Okay, 4. You can put in the prophetess Anna. 5. Okay, so that's all been written out. So the play's been written. The cast pre-exists the production. You are the director. Do you want to put the full cast in here? You and you are choreographer, you are lighting director, you are wardrobe, all of it. So that's great. I love doing that.
So to clarify, would you say that someone like Giotto or Fra Angelico were in a progression trying to reach a certain state and they were part of that process as opposed to kind of regressing and putting on a naive position?
Well, remember, we don't know what they saw or didn't see. They went from, you know, Italy has a strange Gothic period. It's not the same as France and Germany. Their Gothic is a little different, a lot different actually. And so they go from the medieval and almost zoom right into the early Renaissance. I'm one of those people that'll say, okay, this happens through Francis of Assisi, because his poem, Canticle of the Brother, Sun, and Sister Moon, absolutely revolutionized Italian history.
Mm.
Even Sir Kenneth Clark, when he does his Civilization series, he starts out with, he's sitting in the, I don't know if it's the Garden of Santa Croce or... He said, without St. Francis, the Renaissance may have never happened. He was doing that back in the early 70s. But what he did was he took, in the Canticle of Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon, he took the entire creation and he put it in family terms. brother, sister, okay, where the Greeks deified them, he says we're all part of this same cosmology, this same creation.
Right.
And, of course, now it's getting reduced to, oh, patient saint of ecology. Yeah, sure. You'll love Greta. But anyway, yeah, that changed things, the personification of things and putting them in familiar terms really was quite important. So, and of course, these early commissions are all Franciscan, like the Cimabue and the Giotto. You go to Florence, and that's where they are. And of course, in Padua, that's Franciscan.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Okay. So they said, we want this. You know, we want that corporeal. When Saint Francis says things like, "Remember, the flesh of your Christ is no different from the flesh of the person sitting next to you." He was really, you know, it's. I always felt that those three elements of the study of light and shade on opaque form perspective, that this existed in our space and bore our flesh, okay, and anatomy. Those three things brought it all together.
And so for you, is it very obvious and clear that the Renaissance is the highest moment of art history?
I hope it's not. I hope we can somehow get there again. I won't see it, but, you know, because the fact that it remains there and it didn't continue is one of the reasons why it just stays art history. And doesn't seem to continue. The continuity is very, very important. Modernism really ruptured that, for sure, no doubt about it. But I also believe that the church hasn't helped here. The fact that, you know, people like Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Raffaello, here they adorned the Perugino, Botticelli. They adorned, these incredible churches and the Vatican itself. Why hasn't one of them been elevated to servant of God or even blessed like Frangelico or even canonized? Don't tell me there haven't been conversion experiences by someone standing in front of the Pietà or the Sistine Chapel ceiling or going through the Convento San Marco, on and on and on. These were very devout men, as much as modern art history likes to make bad boys all the time. So the church is responsible here. I do think if something like that were to happen, and Michelangelo were to be, for example, elevated to servant of God, the art historians would rip those things out of the books. Can't do it anymore. That's religion. That's not art. So the church has to take some responsibility here in keeping it on the, you know, secular level they were just artists doing a job. I think there was more than that.
Speaking of modernist churches, is there a single modernist church that you approve of?
No. No.
So when you see, like, for instance, Matisse's chapel.
Oh,
I'm quite fond of that, actually. I've never seen it in person, but what is, or Gaudí?
Gaudí's different. No, Gaudí I accept.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Gaudí is a continuation of the Gothic for me.
Interesting. He's also very devout, explicitly devout.
No, Matisse wasn't. Matisse said, art's my religion.
Right.
But, okay, going back to the 1976 41st Eucharistic Congress and the art exhibition that went along with it, what do you think was in there? Here it is. It's not even that old. Matisse's chasubles in glass cases. They're relics. They don't get worn anymore. They're too precious as art. Mm-hmm. I'm glad nobody's wearing them because they're hideous. Have you seen, you know, those chasubles he designed?
They are the, let me see.
He did the stations. He did all the, you know, the tile thing of St. Dominic, and he did the entire interior, but he also did the chasubles for the priests there. And there's one that's pink, black, and white that's just scary.
Yeah, I'm looking at them.
Yeah. But they're relics now. They're too good to be worn. And that says, you see, that's where it really crosses the line the other way. Like, they were designed to be utilitarian, but they're too good now because Henri Matisse did them.
Right. It is a weird inversion.
Mm-hmm.
They're not welcoming their... It's just funny how these hierarchies kind of get inverted or play around. It's clear that there's, first of all, I don't believe it's even possible to erase hierarchy in any sense. It's embedded in reality itself.
Absolutely.
Clearly you can see it here. This object is behind glass and you can't touch it. Okay. So now it's in a sacred position, but its sacred position is very different than if it was used in mass.
That's right.
Which is a form, would be worn by a human, for one. And so there, it's brought down to the level of humanity, which by my estimation is the whole, obviously the incarnation is the whole principle of Christianity, that this is the most important thing. It's a true humanism in that sense. I won't get into how I feel about secular humanism. I don't even know how it arrives at its conclusions, but
no, nor do I. But to see those, for example, and this is where I question not Matisse, but I question the priests themselves. Okay, the pink one, we only wear, we call a rose, two Sundays, you know, Laetare Sunday and Gaudete Sunday. That's it. But the orange one, that's not, there's no orange liturgical season at all. It doesn't exist. So that's just costume. And maybe that's why I got put in the case, because there would never be a Sunday or even a feral day in which you could wear an orange chasuble. It's not one of the, you know, basic liturgical colors for the liturgical seasons. You know, it's not green,
right,
it's not gold, it's not red for a martyr.
Well, there you come back to the... There's no utility, again.
There's no utility, no.
Well, that has me curious, though, in respect to... You like Gaudí. Who else is an exception to your dislike in modernity?
Oh, I don't know their names, all of them, but I do know that whoever did the Padre Pio and Gargano, it's just hideous. It's overbearing. It's just clunky. I don't sense anything about the saint whatsoever. And then there's the Millennium Church that was built in Rome out on the Autostrada. It's pretty bad.
My question was confusing. What do you, in the same vein of Gaudí, what do you like that has come out of modernity?
I like, you know, in terms of contemporary architects.
Mm-hmm.
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I think because Gaudí's taken so long, we've moved on in that sense. And there's people like Duncan Stroik, who's, although it's based on Palladio, that's his main source, that's his go-to guy. He's doing a lot of churches and monasteries and convents and things like that. It is happening. It doesn't, you know, we're not reading it, hearing about it as much. We always go for the one that's going to be the bit, you know, the one that isn't going to be liked. They get more publicity than the ones that we do. It's that same modernist syndrome. And So who's the other guy? Another architect in America. These are American architects. This is not happening in Europe. They would never, ever allow this. You see a capital or a column in Europe and they just, oh, no, not that again. You know,
so, that brings an interesting question to my mind about the difference between your experience in American churches versus European churches. And this question comes from a place of, you know, I was struggling a lot to embrace American church because for me, aesthetically, it can be so bankrupt sometimes. I'm talking about just like a local church. You go to Europe, there's really, really old churches where you can kind of feel the depth of just time, honestly, but also a connection to the root of the thing. For a while, that was preventing me from even engaging with church. But I've since gotten over that. But I'm kind of curious, what's your experience with those two things? Like, does the beauty of a church greatly impact your ability to enter into the church service?
Yes and no. And I'll give you some examples. In the beginning, yes, I'd say I'm going back again, you know, in my early conversion days, because I, like any other good hippie, you don't go to church anymore. So the 70s were a very dry period for me. However, when I was teaching at the school in Florence, I had a particular parish, and here I'm surrounded with all these great places, you know, but I found one little place. The architecture had good bone structure. It was a small Renaissance revival church called Santa Lucia sul Prato, which is at that part of Florence was the fields. So it's St. Lucy's in the fields. Very modest church, typical, you know, Tuscan architecture. What got to me was that although it didn't have any great art, and thank God no tourists coming in and out, it had an incredible community that was very much artistically minded. And so Monday nights after liturgy, we would have these wonderful meetings and discuss things like two people came in to talk about Mantegna, the Gonzaga family, and Down syndrome. And how so many of the depictions of the Christ child seemed to have Down syndrome. And was that something that the family even requested in terms of paint our child? That would not have been unheard of in the Renaissance at all. Hmm. When we think of the Innocenti and every child is in swaddle like the Christ child, and you are to accept every child as if. That would be a talk. And then another time it would be about translating bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh from the Hebrew to the Greek to the Latin to the Italian and what that meant and how it manifests itself artistically. These conversations were not happening at the British Institute or Opera del Duomo or any of these other places that would, you know, host these lectures for the conoscenti. It was amazing. I was really, again, in a very rarefied element. I'm still in touch with the people there. They were they had understood these things again on a very different level. It wasn't art history. They saw the connection to theology, and it was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, my conclusion about all this was, again, it's more about the community and the humanity of the experience than the structure. But as an artist, I'm obviously interested in the architecture of the building. But I came to think that maybe my aesthetic particularities were actually preventing me from engaging with my more human aspects or my heart. And so I would see these brutal kind of blocky marble American churches where there just really seemed to be no understanding of the holistic nature of building the church material wise as well. And it made me consider how often aesthetics might be an actual blockage to the religious experience or to the human experience. Because when I used to make art, I used to draw a lot of comic books holed up in a room. I certainly felt subhuman. And I was certainly making art for art's sake in that sense. And it took going out into the world, in a sense, going out on that adventure of humanity to break that spell. But it also left me in a place of kind of stuck between the individualistic mode and the more, I don't know if devotional is the word, but it's a weird tension, I find.
I think a lot of it has to be retaught, restructured. I mean, I now give two talks a year to seminarians. It's only in their second year, which means in the 8 years they study, they only get me 2 days.
Right.
Okay. And I talk about the hierarchy of forms that are traditionally used, where you're always supposed to get better as you go up toward the sanctuary. It's supposed to be more permanent, more endurable, you know, non-movable, you know, not a table that you can move anywhere, but this solid altar that says, my God, and this is true for most world religions, my God is immovable. You've got both the temporal and, you know, and then you have things like real candles that die down and flicker, you know, that's temporal, incense, temporal, you know, all these things, just like a Buddhist would make a sand painting or something. Right. We have all those things. All religions share those things. But when they're taken away completely, and you're not allowed to sit in your church any longer watching natural light come through and light things, you included, which was the lighting of a lot of those frescoes, there's something is terribly lost. And so this idea that I'm sitting in natural light in front of the tabernacle, I'm in time contemplating eternity. And that is probably what makes great sacred art great, is when we can have those experiences within one particular work of art, and sacred art anyway, where it first of all goes beyond time, but somehow overlaps time and eternity. For me, I see that in a lot of things. I see it in Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. That's heaven and earth combined, circle and square, the two separate centers. That's a very, very, you know, for me, a very theologically based drawing of creation. So, but we're not being taught these things, you know. So I'm hoping that through education, somebody's going to say, hey, I'm going to take this a little bit further.
Right.
For their own experience, you know, for their own experience. But,
the most beautiful light I've seen in a church is actually in Gaudí's La Sagrada. It was unbelievable light. Unbelievable.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And we use that in lectures. Gaudí is part of talking about contemporary aesthetics and architecture. I went to a lecture years ago by a woman named Anna Griswold Ting, and she said there's four phases, and we keep repeating them throughout world history, where it starts out with the monolithic. Okay, mm-hmm. It's verticality, totemic. Then it goes to the rotational or circular, where you're in control of the environment. You see this over and over again throughout all world structures. Then it goes, say, where the 6 o'clock would be. And she called that helical. Interesting, because it's the helix from under the underworld to the heavens, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know. And then the last is spiral. spiral is different from helical because it both goes in and out and up and down. That's Gaudí. Okay. And she said the Gothic was a helical period, excuse me, a spiral period. And you go to Milan and you walk on the roof and all those spires, you're lost in this forest. It's amazing. And I've taken that to some of my classes because I applied it to then. She applied it to architecture. I apply it to drawing, painting, sculpture, all of it.
Right.
Okay. So, and it can be done very easily, but it's a great structure in her, you know, going from the Apollonian to the Dionysian, all these things that were all combined in one lecture. It was amazing. Unfortunately, she didn't do a book on it, but and I take it further, you know, to creation. And, you know, we have nebulae that take these forms on, monolithic, rotational, helical, and spiral. It's all there. It's all in creation. You know, it's you know, God's provided us with a map for design.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a very beautiful way to break it down.
Yeah. So it's in our plants. It's all growths. We're bilateral. That's where you go from, you know, the monolithic to the bilateral. That's what we are.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, all of creation is done in those basic elements. And again, you know, instead of bringing in the garden hose, do something else. You know.
Well, I'm going to end it on this Bishop Fulton Sheen quote I really like, and I think it summarizes what we said well, and that's, marry the spirit of the age and you become a widow in the next.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, thank you, Bishop Sheen.
He's great. He's amazing.
All right, Michael.
Well, good talking to
Michael's,
you.
Same here, Michael. Thanks so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Music by Dori Bavarsky and Mingjia Chen. Next up, we have Dan Nadel. Enjoy your week.
Let's go.